Eclipse edition of Don Edel Mundo, led by me, DJ Madam B, and in this edition, transcending excellence in mood and theme, in music by women worldwide, in our weekly showcase of global music by women. This is Emerging Arts Production.
From WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV, LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, December 13th. Your lucky day. A state appeals court dismissed a defamation lawsuit Michael Flynn filed against a political strategist and Never Trump activist. Flynn, who lives in Sarasota and campaigns for right-wing causes, sued Rick Wilson over two social media posts. In them, Wilson called Flynn a Putin employee and said, quote, "Mike Flynn is Q." Flynn is a former national security advisor for Donald Trump, convicted of lying to the FBI over his relations to Russian officials. Flynn filed the lawsuit last year in Sarasota County, but Circuit Judge Hunter Carroll ruled for Wilson on January 30th. Now, a three-judge panel of the Second District Court of Appeal rejected Flynn's appeal. The appeals judges said that Wilson's attacks against a public figure were protected by the First Amendment and that Flynn could not establish actual malice. Wilson is a longtime Florida Republican strategist, major critic of Trump, and founder of the Lincoln Project. In Manatee County, more workforce housing is underway. A nonprofit is looking to build housing for lower-income workers near Sarasota-Bradenton International Airport. The five-story building would feature 72 apartments. The rent for a one-bedroom apartment would range from $660 to $1,500 a month. Manatee County recently agreed to help the developer secure a $2 million loan to buy the land on North Tamiami Trail that featured the recently closed Primo Ristorante. In the Northport, Bradenton, Sarasota metro area, one-third of renters spent more than 30% of their income on rent. Meanwhile, a survey among Manatee County teachers showed that most are looking for an affordable place to live. The vast majority of 280 respondents said they would be open to the idea of living in an affordable apartment complex built for district employees. The Manatee County School Board is weighing a developer's plan to build 132 apartments for district employees on 5 acres of district-owned land in Bradenton. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, December 13th.
Listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. Is it just me, or doesn't it seem like the president-elect has been around for way more than the month or so since the election? He does have a talent for getting himself maximum news coverage, which unfortunately for all Americans are mostly dire warnings of what may happen when he actually takes charge. I find it curious that it seems no one besides the president-elect believes that his proposed policies will accomplish their stated goals. But then, this was the election pitting deep state experts against gut feelings. So I guess offering explanations based on fact may be triggering for the anti-knowledge crew. Even the first pal, Elon Musk, has quietly admitted that the cuts to basically everything that he and Vivek Ramaswamy are planning will be painful for many. But as we know, that did not matter for little more than half the country. Now we all get to deal with the consequences. But the actions of the president-elect have taught us anything, it is that the system can be used to stop or at least slow some of the more damaging policies. Hear this story about how the conservative Supreme Court, trying to dilute the government's regulating authority, handed the resistance a powerful tool. A major U.S. Supreme Court decision this summer was hailed as a conservative court's broadside against Democratic administration, giving red states more backing to delay or overturn policies they didn't like, such as transgender protections and clean energy goals. But the ruling in the Loper-Bright case, which granted courts more power to scrutinize federal rules, can go both ways. Experts say it will most likely give blue states more leeway to attack any forthcoming policy changes from President-elect Donald Trump, ranging from immigration and the environment to Medicaid and civil rights. The decision overturns a legal concept called the Chevron defense, in place since 1984 and named after the case involving the Chevron Oil Company. That ruling granted federal agencies wide discretion in interpreting vague laws that had been passed by Congress and sent to the executive branch to sort out the details. Generally, courts deferred to the agency regulations. Chevron deference became a superstar of the court, cited in more than 18,000 federal court decisions. The latest ruling wipes that all away. Experts said it will boost blue state resistance to Trump policies. Lawsuits are already being planned in many state houses as California holds a special session to set aside money for legal fights, and other states such as Connecticut, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, and New York also talk court strategy. Democratic governors in Colorado and Illinois formed a coalition in November to fortify essential democratic rights nationwide. In effect, the ruling opens up more federal rules to those court challenges. Blue states now have a new weapon to fight conservative federal rules on issues such as immigration, climate change, abortion access, and civil rights. Ironically, the original 1984 decision establishing more power for federal agencies was made by a conservative court that was paving the way for deregulation in the Reagan administration, noted Leonard Coelho, a research professor at Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy Center for Children and Families. It was the case that really opened the door to Reagan deregulation, sort of untying the hands of the federal agencies by saying, "We're going to give you a lot of slack to start doing things," Coelho said. Fast forwarding to today, and overturning Chevron really had the opposite effect, Coelho said. "You're handcuffing the new Trump administration agency from deregulating. It makes it hard for an agency to build out new things that make it hard to undo existing things," he said. There's some irony in the fact that a conservative majority issued that ruling just before a conservative administration took office. Some Trump allies still see the ruling as a weapon against excessive regulation. Vivek Ramaswamy, chosen by Trump alongside tech billionaire Elon Musk to lead an advisory body the president-elect named the Department of Government Efficiency, said that in a December post on X that the decision paves the way for not a slight but drastic reduction in the scope of the federal regulatory state. But most experts see the change as an obstacle to new Trump administration looking to make sweeping changes, but lacking enough support in Congress to pass large-scale legislation. Any proposals restricting access to abortion or attempting to dismantle the Affordable Care Act or Medicaid expansion will be more complicated, said Zachary Barron, director of the Center for Health Policy and Law at Georgetown University's O'Neill Institute. All these new policies are going to be challenged in court, and state attorneys general will certainly be leading the way, Barron said, and I think there'll be a lot of big legal fights to come. Now, it could become harder for the Trump administration to deregulate areas of the economy, crack down on immigration, impose work requirements on Medicare recipients, and remove protections for gender and LGBTQ plus status. The Biden administration similarly has run into roadblocks. We have already seen conservative judges point to Looper Bright as one reason to block the Biden administration efforts to expand the reach of non-discriminatory protections, including with respect to the LGBTQ plus folks, Barron said. For instance, federal courts in Florida, Mississippi, and Texas, in response to lawsuits brought by various Republican states, prevented the Affordable Care Act rule banning gender identity-based discrimination from taking effect in July. Each rule cited Looper Bright as one factor. With Trump's election, it's now blue states that have a sharper tool to combat Republican agendas. To the extent that the Trump administration tries to radically rewrite these non-discrimination protections again, he may well find that Democrats, state AGs, will be able to successfully block such efforts as a result of Looper Bright, also, Barron said. Congress has not approved a major immigration or environmental law for decades that has forced both Democratic and Republican administrations to change policy through either executive orders or federal regulations that can now be more easily challenged by hostile states and courts. Civil rights protections are being flipped upside down to shield white men from discrimination. President-elect Donald Trump is set to challenge policies aimed at boosting diversity in companies and universities when he takes office next month, throwing the weight of the U.S. government behind growing conservative opposition to such practices. The Justice Department and other federal agencies are likely to start investigations and bring lawsuits over diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, as they argue that many of these practices violate anti-discrimination laws. DEI is unlawful discrimination, said Mike Davis, the founder of the Article 3 Project, a conservative advocacy group who has advised Trump on legal issues. It's illegal for the government to do it. It's illegal for universities to do it, and it's illegal for companies to do it. The plans would turn the power of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, created in 1957 to enforce laws aimed at stopping discrimination against black people and other marginalized communities, against policies designed to benefit those groups. Trump signaled his intent this week when he tapped lawyer Harmit Dhillon as his pick to oversee the division as an assistant attorney general, saying that her career highlights include suing corporations who use woke policies to discriminate against their workers. Proponents of DEI policies say that they needed to address longstanding racial inequities in U.S. society, while opponents argue that many of the policies are exclusionary and that they focus on race and gender at the expense of individual merit. Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which forbids racial discrimination in programs that receive federal funds, could empower the Justice Department to challenge university admissions practices and racial equity programs in healthcare. The argument is going to be, to the extent that there is a consideration of race in any context by any entity that receives federal funds, that's a problem under Title VI, said Danielle Conley, the head of the anti-discrimination practice law firm Latham & Watkins. Trump vowed in his campaign video to direct the Justice Department to pursue civil rights investigations into universities, saying that they've been captured by the radical left. We're going to get this anti-American insanity out of our institutions once and for all, Trump said in the video that was posted in July. The Trump's transition team did not respond to a request for comment. Legal challenges could include claims that universities are not following U.S. Supreme Court's 2023 ruling barring consideration of race in college admissions. The Justice Department, under Democratic President Joe Biden, has defended an exemption allowing U.S. military academies to continue using affirmative action policies, a stance Trump could reverse. During Trump's first term, the Justice Department sued Yale University, alleging that its admissions practices discriminated against Asian Americans and white applicants. The lawsuit was later dropped under the Biden administration. Even in situations where the Justice Department does not have direct enforcement authority, the government could still weigh in on existing cases to argue that its interpretation of civil rights laws aligns with others challenging DEI policies. America First Legal, a conservative group founded by Trump advisor Stephen Miller, has brought 15 lawsuits since 2022, targeting major companies like Facebook and Instagram owner Meta Platforms and Amazon.com over their diversity efforts. Seven of those cases, including the complaints against Meta and Amazon, have been dismissed by judges, found that the person or group suing did not suffer harm that would allow them to sue. America First Legal has appealed some of those decisions. America First Legal did not respond to requests for comment. The America First Legal cases are part of a larger effort to pressure companies to scrap practices aimed at boosting racial and ethnic representation in the workplace. Many of their legal challenges were brought on behalf of white men using laws passed during the post-Civil War Reconstruction era and the Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and the 60s designed to support black Americans. It would be a betrayal of the mission of the Civil Rights Division to turn it into a legal force that protects primarily the interests of white men, said Thomas Healy, a Seton Hall University law professor who has written about civil rights issues. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Medicare is changing for the better thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act. Florida has more people getting their health insurance from the federal government than any other state other than California. More than one out of every 10 Floridians are on traditional Medicare. Add in the other 2.5 million people who are using Medicare Advantage through private insurers, and about one out of every 5 people in Florida relies on some version of Medicare to help pay for their health care. On November 8th, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services released the 2025 premiums, deductibles, and coinsurance amounts for Medicare Part A and Part B programs and the 2025 Medicare Part D income-related monthly adjustment amounts. Medicare Part B, which covers physician services, outpatient hospital services, certain home health care services, durable medical equipment, and certain other medical and health services, not covered by Medicare Part 1 and Medicare Part 1 Part A, which covers inpatient hospital skilled nursing facilities and hospice inpatient rehabilitation and some home health care services, will both increase their monthly premiums. The most significant changes to Medicare 2025 is the implementation of the $2,000 annual out-of-pocket cap for Part D prescription drugs, thanks to provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act. But it's more important to make sure that the plan you choose covers the medications you're taking. The plans are required to have a certain number of medications for every purpose, with the exception of a few categories of drugs, such as cancer drugs or AIDS drugs, says Jim Tolbert, a Medicare consultant counselor in Tampa, through the Serving Health Insurance Needs of Elders SHINE program offered by the Florida Department of Elder Affairs. They don't have to cover every medication, just certain numbers for the purpose. And they try to construct a formulary that will be cost-effective and provide good benefits for the enrollees, but they don't have to cover every medication. Also new in 2025 is the manufacturer discount program, replacing a previous coverage gap discount program and requirement that all Medicare prescription drugs plans offer enrollees the option to pay out-of-pocket prescription drug costs in the form of capped monthly payments instead of all at once at the pharmacy. with the first 10 high-cost drugs that we negotiated for the Medicare program on behalf of millions of people who take these drugs. We are balancing innovation and a fair price for people and the negotiations, says Dr. Mina Sesmana, director of the Center for Medicare with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. We estimate that we saved Medicare $6 billion and, importantly, saved people with Medicare prescription drug coverage $1.5 billion. So enabling people to access these drugs and ensure stability and sustainability of the Medicare program. This past summer, CMS also launched the Guiding and Improved Dementia Experience model, a voluntary nationwide model test that aims to support people with dementia and their unpaid caregivers. The model began January 1st, 2024, and will run for 8 years. The list has 31 providers and organizations in Florida providing these benefits. It's not about treating a diagnosis code, it's about caring for people, and we know how vital caregivers are to care for that person. So the GUIDE model, particularly for people with dementia, provides additional supports for caregivers, including respite care, training, providing upfront money to healthcare providers so that they can better support caregivers, Sasumani said. She said the model is being tested to see if it should be incorporated into a broader Medicare program in the future. It's important to note, Sesemani said, that Medicare already pays for healthcare providers to train family caregivers in things like toileting and helping their loved ones do routine activities, behavioral management, direct care, and wound care. The deadline to sign up for Medicare passed this weekend, but there is a special enrollment period that runs from January 1st through March 31st, during which you will be able to switch to a different Advantage plan or return to original Medicare and enroll in a drug plan. But the special enrollment period does not apply to people who are on or are in original Medicare. When choosing plans, experts say it's important to consider out-of-pocket costs in addition to monthly premiums. Nobel Prize winners are warning that appointing RFK head of healthcare will be a disaster, something he probably believes is a badge of honor. A group of 75 Nobel laureates are concerned that there will be a disaster for public health with someone like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. leading the Department of Health and Human Services. The New York Times reports that it's the first time in recent memory that Nobel laureates have banded together against a cabinet choice, according to the 1993 winner Richard Roberts, who helped draft the letter to senators. The physiologist called out Kennedy for political attacks on science, which he called very damaging. You have to stand up and protect it, Roberts added. The letter says Kennedy, an environmental lawyer by trade, lacks credentials in medicine and science. Placing Mr. Kennedy in charge of GHHS would put the public's health in jeopardy and undermine America's global leadership in the health sciences, he continues. Kennedy has a history of vaccine skepticism and seeks to withdraw fluoridation in drinking water. The letter also points out that Kennedy has been a belligerent critic of the government agencies he would oversee, such as Food and Drug Administration, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the National Institutes of Health. Kennedy has already pledged to fire hundreds of NIH employees and alleged that the FDA waged a war on public health. The leader of DHHS should continue to nurture and improve, not threaten, these important and highly respected institutions and their employees, the letter says. Science is dependent on the political structures of this country, Roberts said. I don't think we should be burying our heads in the sand just because we're scientists. He added, maybe there are some who will read this and think, well, we really do want to protect the health of our citizens. They didn't elect us so that we could kill them. Speaking of Nobelists, economist Paul Krugman penned his last column for the New York Times. Famed New York Times columnist Paul Krugman gave a bleak goodbye in his final piece for the paper this week, but left with a glimmer of hope for the future. The Nobel Prize-winning economist looked back on the 25 years since he penned his first opinion piece and despaired at what the world has become. What strikes me looking back is how optimistic many people, both here and in much of the Western world, were back then, and the extent to which that optimism has been replaced by anger and resentment, he wrote as he retired from the Times. And I'm not just talking about members of the working class who feel betrayed by the elites. Some of the angriest and most resentful people in America right now, people who seem very likely to have a lot of influence with the incoming Trump administration, are billionaires who don't feel sufficiently admired. In 1999, he wrote that there was a feeling of satisfaction and excitement for the future, but he said in the 2000 election was that many Americans took peace and prosperity for granted. So they voted for the guy who seemed as if he'd be more fun to hang out with. Why did this optimism curdle, he asked. As I see it, we've had a collapse of trust in elites. The public no longer has faith that the people running things know what they're doing, or that we can assume that they're being honest. He remembered the reluctance in believing in 2002 that an American president would pursue fraudulent reasons to invade Iraq. Who would say that now? He asked. In a different way, the financial crisis of 2008 undermined any faith the public had that the government knew how to manage economies. But he saved much of his ire and blame for the state of the world for the super rich. Some of the most resentful people in America right now seem to be angry billionaires, he said. Basically, it comes down to the pettiness of plutocrats who used to bask in public approval and are now discovering that all the money in the world can't buy you love. So, is there a way out of this grim place we're in? What I believe is that while resentment can put bad people in power, in the long run, it can't keep them there. At some point, the public will realize that most politicians railing against elites actually are elites in the very sense that matters, and start to hold them accountable for their failures to deliver on their promises. And at the point that the public may be willing to listen to people who don't try to argue from authority, don't make false promises, but do try to tell the truth as best they can. Pairing of major egotist Elon Musk with off-the-rails conspiracy theorist Marjorie Taylor Greene, it's not expected to end. Donald Trump's newly built department that aims to slash federal funding is set for implosion as the president-elect throws together a pair of ticking time bombs, a reporter predicted this week. With Elon Musk and Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene working side by side, the Department of Government Efficiency will devolve into crazy town, said New Republic's Greg Sargent in his Wednesday New Republic Daily Blast rundown. The new government agency, headed by Tesla CEO Musk and entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, is tasked with shifting through the entire federal government to find drastic cuts. On the congressional side, a matching committee is being set up to work with the executive branch on the cuts. Speaker Mike Johnson has named Greene to head the congressional side. What could give MAGA a bigger thrill than that high wattage duo, asked Greg Sargent in Wednesday's New Republic Daily Blast. Last month, Greene was ridiculed for being named to the position despite having sporadic congressional attendance. This is good, actually, Rep. Andrea Ocasio-Cortez wrote on X. She barely shows up and doesn't do the reading. To borrow a phrase I saw elsewhere, it's like giving someone an unplugged controller. A Politico report said that Republicans quietly fear that Greene's involvement could become a major distraction for the Trump GOP agenda, said Sargent. He noted that distraction in Washington speak means disaster. Sargent then interviewed tech writer Gil Doran, who has been a close observer of Musk's machinations. Doran said he thinks Musk intends to use the opportunity to gain attention. on a daily basis. Elon Musk has to be the center of attention at all times. The goal is to cut one-third of the federal budget, which is approximately $2 trillion. Duran said doing so means sweeping changes to programs people need and want. When many Americans begin to feel the effects of the cuts, it will become a political problem for those in the House and the Senate. I think he sees the government as a butterfly he can pull the wings off, Duran said. I think he'll find it's a lot more complicated and dangerous than that. As for Green, Dunn called her a ticking time bomb, which is a problem because Musk, he said, is the same. I think the first thing that tells me, about Doge is that this is going to be crazy town, Duran continued. Green has no filter and no standards, and Musk and Trump are trying to make it this as outrageous as possible, with little concern for public opinions. So Marjorie Taylor Greene being included, it's like throwing gasoline on a fire. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Republican governors around the country are pledging to facilitate threatened mass deportations. As President-elect Donald Trump assembles his administration, Republican governors and lawmakers in some states are already rolling out proposals that could help him carry out his pledge to deport millions of people living in the U.S. illegally. Lawmakers in a growing number of states are proposing to give local law officers the power to arrest people who entered the country legally. Mirroring recent laws in Texas and elsewhere that have been placed on hold while courts weigh whether they unconstitutionally usurp federal authority. Other legislation filed ahead of next year's legislative session would require local law enforcement agencies to notify federal immigration officials when they take someone into custody who is in the country legally, even if the charges have nothing to do with their immigration status. Though not specifically requested by Trump, many of the state proposals would complement his immigration policies. We would be finding people who are in violation of this law, and we would sort of be hand-delivering them to the nearest port of deportation so that they could be removed in a safe and orderly fashion, said Missouri State Senator Curtis Trent, who was sponsoring one of the proposals. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security estimates that 11 million unauthorized immigrants were living in the U.S. as of 2022, the latest statistics available. While campaigning, Trump talked about creating the largest mass deportation program in history and called for using the National Guard and domestic police forces in the effort. Some Democratic-led states are already raising resistance. California legislature has convened a special session to try to shield people from potential Trump policies, including by boosting legal aid for immigrants facing deportation. Lawmakers in numerous states are likely to try to thwart or cooperate with Trump's immigration agenda, Tim Story, CEO of the National Conference of State Legislatures, said this week. In Missouri, Trent's bill would empower local law enforcement to arrest people for a new state crime of improper entry by an alien, punishable by a fine of up to $100,000 and a court-ordered ride to the U.S. border. A separate bill by Missouri State Senator-elect David Gregory would offer a $1,000 reward to informants who tip off police about people in the country illegally and allow private bounty hunters to find and detain them. Missouri Republican Governor-elect Mike Kehoe hasn't endorsed a specific legislative plan after campaigning against illegal immigration and the scourge of fentanyl smuggled across the U.S. border. But he told the Associated Press, if they're here illegally, it definitely should trigger something more than it does now. immigrant advocacy groups are already raising the alarm about some state proposals. Missouri's proposed bounty system would create absolute chaos and division, said Ashley D'Alzevedo, president of the American Families United, which advocates for U.S. citizens married to foreign nationals. Although many Americans support a path for citizenship for people living in the United States illegally, support for deportations has also grown. More than 4 in 10 voters said that most immigrants who are in the U.S. illegally should be deported to the country they came from, according to AP VoteCast, a survey of more than 120,000 voters in this year's election. That's up from about 3 in 10 in 2020. More than half the voters said that immigrants in the U.S. illegally should be offered a chance to apply for legal status, down from about 7 in 10 who said this in 2020, according to AP VoteCast. 3 J6 defendants from Polk County await their trial patiently and expect pardons. Most of the nation's 734 immigration judges are seeking to reinstate their union ahead of an expected spike in immigration cases from President-elect Trump's planned mass deportations. The judge's appeal, scheduled to go before the Federal Labor Relations Authority, the FLRA, on Tuesday, seeked to restore their right to bargain for contractors and have a union, a right stripped from them during Trump's first term. Immigration judges are expecting a huge surge in cases, adding to the already historic backlog of 3.7 million cases once Trump launches his proposed mass deportations of millions of undocumented immigrants. The U.S. immigration system's backlog will take an estimated 4 years to resolve at the current pace, which could balloon to 16 years under Trump's deportation plan, according to an Axios analysis. Of the 3.7 million pending cases, 1.6 million involve asylum seekers awaiting formal hearings or case decisions. The Trump-controlled FLRA stripped the NAIJ of its bargaining power and its union power in 2020 after calling judges managers who weren't eligible for union representation. The NAIJ challenged a decision in federal court and won a ruling that said immigration judges were entitled to union representation. They need a voice as workers, as immigration judges, said Matthew Biggs, president of the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers, which, representing 90,000 public, private, and federal sector workers in the U.S. and Canada. Biggs said the immigration judges want fair representation and are worried about being overwhelmed, even more with the jump in new cases. The union says judges typically spend only about 30 minutes on each case because of the pressure to tackle the backlog. Immigration courts closed 900,000 cases from October 1, 2023 to September 30, 2024, according to data from the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse at Syracuse University. That was the most cleared cases in a fiscal year, and 235,000 more than previous year. An FLRA decision on union issue could come in 6 weeks. 3 J6 defendants from Polk County await their trial patiently and expect pardons. The trials of 3 January 6 defendants from Polk County have been pushed back to February. Siblings Jonathan Pollock and Olivia Pollock of North Lakeland and their friend Joseph Hutchinson III had been scheduled for trials to begin on January 27th. An order issued Friday, though, by Circuit Court Judge Carl Nichols of the District of Columbia, set their trials to begin February 17th. All three face felony charges related to their alleged participation in the U.S. Capitol riot of January 6, 2021. Jonathan Pollock, 25, faces 17 counts on such charges as civil disorder, assaulting, resisting, or impeding police officers, using a dangerous weapon, theft of government property, entering or remaining in a restricted building or grounds with a deadly or dangerous weapon, and an act of physical violence in the Capitol grounds or building. Olivia Pollock, 34, is charged with assaulting, resisting, or impeding officers outside the U.S. Capitol, as well as entering or remaining in a restricted area in an act of physical violence on the Capitol grounds and disorderly and disruptive conduct. Hutchinson, 28, faces two counts of assaulting or resisting officers, entering or remaining in a restricted building, disorderly conduct, and engaging in violence in a restricted building or grounds. Jonathan Pollock evaded arrest after an indictment in 2021 and remained a fugitive for 2.5 years. Hutchinson and Olivia Pollock, both arrested in June of 2021, were originally released on bond while awaiting trial. Days before the trial was set to begin in March 2023, both disabled their GPS monitors and also became fugitives, according to prosecutors. FBI agents captured all three at a ranch in Lake County on January 6th of this year, the third anniversary of the Capitol attack. All three are being held in jail in Washington, D.C. while awaiting their trials. Hutchinson, a friend of the Pollocks, lived in North Lakeland at the time of his arrest. He had been living in Georgia before he became a fugitive, according to court records. Hutchinson filed a motion last month asking Nichols to vacate his scheduled trial, citing President-elect Donald Trump's repeated pledges to pardon January 6th defendants. Trump will be inaugurated on January 20th. In the motion, Hutchinson said that he would not be a flight risk, writing that no one is going to flee from a trial that is never coming. I will await my pardon like any responsible person would. Nichols directed the prosecution and defense to file any additional motions by December 27th. A pretrial conference is scheduled for February 10th. New sex education curricula for middle schoolers in Florida judiciously avoids any mention of sex. A new middle school sex education curriculum in Orange County, Florida, obtained by Popular Information, eliminates previous lessons on reproductive system, contraception, and consent. What remains is a discussion of the benefits of abstinence and a cursory review of various sexually transmitted diseases. Orange County's new curriculum, provided to Popular Information by the Florida Freedom to Read Project, was recently approved by the Florida Department of Education. This approval was required as part of a law, HB 1069, signed by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in May of 2023. The law requires schools to teach abstinence from sexual activities outside of marriage as the expected standard for all school-age students. The new Orange County 8th grade sex education curriculum, for example, emphasizes that abstinence is the only 100% effective method to prevent sexually transmitted diseases or pregnancies. The same information was included in Orange County's previous 8th grade sex education curriculum taught in previous years and submitted to the Florida Department of Education for the 2023-24 school year, but never approved. A very large amount of material has been removed from the sex education curriculum. The 8th grade sex education curriculum submitted last year but not approved is 230 pages. The new approved version, 36 pages. The old curriculum included basic information about human anatomy that has now been eliminated. Eliminating this information was not required by the new law. Rather, the law requires the Department of Education to approve sex education materials as, quote, appropriate for the grade and the age of the student. According to the Orlando Sentinel, Department of Education officials told educators in Broward County, Florida, that pictures of external sexual reproductive anatomy should not be included in any grade level. Officials in Orange County appear to have received similar instructions. A Florida Department of Education spokesperson defended the new restrictions, telling the AP, A state government should not be emphasizing or encouraging sexual activity among children or minors and is therefore right to emphasize abstinence. The old eighth grade sex education curriculum in Orange County, while promoting abstinence, acknowledged that some students are sexually active. It provided information on how to prevent unintended pregnancy and protect against STDs if students engaged in sexual activity. This information has been deleted from the new curriculum. The old Orange County 8th grade curriculum also included information about various kinds of birth control, their efficacy, and whether or not they helped reduce the risk of STDs. This information has also been removed. According to the Orlando Sentinel, state officials told Broward County that contraceptives are not part of any health or science standard. Instead, contraceptives could only be mentioned as a health resource. In Orange County's new 8th grade curriculum, there are no descriptions of different forms of birth control and no explanation of which forms of birth control are effective in preventing the transmission of STDs. This is a particularly important issue in Florida, which is currently reporting more HIV diagnoses than any other state. Previously, Orange County's 8th grade sex education curriculum included a detailed lesson about the importance of consent before engaging in sexual activity. Elsa Barr, a professor of public health at the University of North Florida, said that schools across Florida have also been ordered to remove consent, mentioning consent from sexual materials curriculum. All discussions of consent have been removed from the new Orange County 8th grade sex education curriculum. During the 2023-24 school year, several of Florida's largest school districts, including Orange, Hillsborough, and Polk counties, decided not to teach sex education because the Florida Department of Education never approved their proposed curricula. The Florida Department of Education hired unnamed experts to review each proposed sex education curriculum. These experts were then required to evaluate all materials on 11 separate criteria, some of which were inscrutable. Experts were paid $330 per each completed review. That process has finally been completed, at least in Orange County, for the 2024-2025 school year. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Desmond Mead is an inspiration to us all and just got a street named for him. Prominent voting rights activist Dr. Desmond Mead was honored last week with a street renaming ceremony in his honor. A portion of Southwest 268th Street in South Miami-Dade County, or Moody Drive, will now be known as Desmond Mead Street. The street, now named after him, holds personal significance for Mead, president of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. It is that very street that he grew up near as a young man struggling with addiction and homelessness. I walk this street as a drug addict, and today I walk it with pride, knowing that now stands as a beacon of hope for those who need it most. Mead shared his remarks during the December 6th ceremony at Naranja. This street is not just for me. It's for everyone who has ever felt they didn't have a second chance. Mead's journey is one of resilience. Shortly after graduating high school, he joined the United States Army, where he served as a helicopter mechanic. As a returning citizen, he faced drug addiction, homelessness, and incarceration. Mead was living in a homeless shelter when he decided to enroll in Miami-Dade College, where he graduated with honors in 2010. He then went on to earn his law degree from Florida International University College of Law, graduating in 2013. Today, Mead serves at the helm of FRRC, a grassroots membership organization that run by returning citizens, formerly convicted persons. The organization is dedicated to ending the disenfranchisement of convicted individuals by creating a more comprehensive and humane reentry system, in turn reducing recidivism and increasing public safety. Meade led the FRRC to a historic victory in 2018 with the passage of Amendment 4, which restored the ability of Floridians with past convictions to vote. Amendment 4 ended the lifetime ban on voting for more than 1.4 million people residing in the state and represented the largest expansion of voting rights in a half century. Meade's work also earned him a place on Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People of 2019 and a Nobel Peace Prize nomination in 2023. He was named as Floridian and Central Floridian of the Year in 2019 and a Ford Foundation Global Fellow in 2020 and a 2021 MacArthur Genius Fellow. Miami-Dade Vice Chair Keona L. McGee sponsored the resolution to co-designate a portion of the street in Meade's honor. Desmond Meade Street stands as a testament to the enduring impact of a man who not only overcame his own adversity, but made it his mission to change the lives of others, said McGee. His tireless fight for justice has restored dignity to over 1.4 million Floridians and reshaped our state's history. McGee further emphasized the importance of recognizing and celebrating figures like Meade while they are still with us. Desmond Meade's legacy is one that will continue to inspire us for generations to come, he said. We are grateful for the opportunity to honor him today. Thank you, Desmond, for showing us the power of change starts within and for being a shining example of what is possible when we never give up on ourselves. South Florida legislator is trying again to enact protections from the heat for workers. Broward Democratic Rep. Michael Gottlieb has filed legislation to require employers to provide shade and drinking water to outdoor workers. Although the legislation passed a law last year prohibiting local governments from enacting such protections. This is the third time Gottlieb has tried to pass legislation protecting workers from heat-related illnesses. In the last 2 years, his efforts have stalled at the first committee hearing. However, heat protections took central role in Tallahassee earlier this year as Republicans pushed for passage of HB 433, which barred local governments from regulating workplace heat exposure as the Miami-Dade County Commission considered such protections. While the move garnered criticism from environmental, faith, and progressive groups, it had the backing of the business lobby. Gottlieb's bill, HB 35, would require employers to provide drinking water in a 10-minute breaks every 2 hours when the heat index reaches 90 degrees. In June, Florida ranked second among states with the most 9/11 calls for heat-related incidents, according to the federal database. There's been a bipartisan support in the past to enact the most basic protections for Florida's workers and businesses, including education and training programs on heat illness prevention, access to water and shade, and short breaks throughout hot days, Gottlieb wrote to the Florida Phoenix. This bill follows in the same bipartisan model. Many Florida businesses are already doing this and more, and this bill will just level the playing field for all businesses. A small number of influential business owners are concerned that these basic steps go too far, and they have succeeded in not only blocking statewide standards, but also barring local governments from taking action on this growing problem. It is time to act, and this bill simply creates safety measures that should be in place, creating common sense worker protections that increase productivity and help decrease insurance premiums or public hospital visits. When lawmakers voted to block heat protections, Republicans argued that those kinds of regulations fell under the jurisdiction of OSHA, and the law gives the agency until 2028 to come up with any protections before the Florida Department of Commerce would create statewide rules on workplace heat exposure. The Biden administration announced in July a proposed rule to prevent heat-related illnesses in the workplace, which requires employees to take a 15-minute breaks every 2 hours, but OSHA has delayed the period for submitting comments on the rule until January 14th, after President-elect Donald Trump assumes office again. Environmental groups are protesting the drilling of a proposed oil well near the Apalachicola River. A coalition of about 70 environmental groups commandeered the front entrance of the Florida Department of Environmental Protection this week to protest the department's decision to permit an exploratory oil well along the Apalachicola River. The Kill the Drill Coalition, led by nonprofit Apalachicola Riverkeeper Group and including the Federal Wildlife Federation, Sierra Club, and the Wakulla Springs Alliance, want Governor Ron DeSantis to stop plans by Clearwater Land and Minerals to drill through a lime rock pad north of Dead Lakes in Calhoun County, about 60 miles west of the state capital. DEP's announcement in May to greenlight the project immediately drew protests and administrative challenge from the Apalachicola Riverkeeper. It also sparked strong opposition from a bipartisan coalition of local lawmakers. The first day of hearings into the challenge also began Monday in Tallahassee. Drilling opponents scheduled a news event at the DEP Tallahassee headquarters on Commonwealth Boulevard during a break in the proceedings. The department said that the project is in accordance with Florida laws to protect natural resources. But in court filings and on the steps of the front door, more than a dozen speakers questioned the wisdom of permitting an oil well in the middle of what the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, designated the Apalachicola Biosphere Region, part of an extensive global network of places to conserve natural and cultural resources. UNESCO declared that the Apalachicola River Bay and its watershed to be one of the least polluted and most underdeveloped resource-rich systems left in the United States. The watershed feeds the Apalachicola Bay and produces thousands of seafood and tourism jobs in Wakulla, Franklin, and Gulf counties. Organizers had printed more than 500 Stop the Drill signs, and many people showed up with homemade signs saying our right clean water and remember BP, a reference to the 2010 massive oil spill that contributed to the collapse of the Bay's oyster fishery. Oyster farmer Joe Chaitel Bavera of Apalachicola was among the speakers. She said she spoke on behalf of the working people of the Big Bend Coast, crabbers, shrimpers, fishermen, and women, along with the bartenders and waitstaff at Apalachicola restaurants and the house cleaners of St. George's Islands, all dependent on clean water for the seafood and tourism industries. At a moment in time when there is a lot of disagreement in the world, there is unanimous agreement among the people of Apalachicola Bay that to drill a few miles up the river from our precious bay is absolute insanity, Bavera said. The Clearwater site lies within a 144,000-acre floodplain that is home to some of the rarest plants in the world, including the Torreya tree, and has the highest species density of amphibians and reptiles in North America. Botanists say that there are more than 1,300 different plants in the Apalachicola River Valley, according to Earth Justice, and the National Wildlife Federation counts more than 131 fish species in the river, more than any other river in Florida. The abundance and the variety of life along the Apalachicola is such that in 1936, Republican nominee to be governor was convinced the biblical Garden of Eden was located along Alum Bluff, a mile north of Bristol. L.V.E. Calloway wrote a book to document his findings. In the opening statements in the hearing of the Riverkeeper's Challenge, Clearwater Land and Minerals attorney Thomas Riley explained the current plan is the same plan that DEP okayed in 2019 and then was abandoned 2 years later by a different oil company. Staffers at Thank You Books in Birmingham, Alabama, San Francisco City Lights Books, and The Nook in Cedar Falls, Iowa, are among 600 booksellers receiving $500 holiday bonuses from James Patterson, the best-selling novelist, who's been awarding independent store employees since 2015. Booksellers save lives, period, Patterson said in a statement released this week through his publisher, Little Brown & Company. I am happy to be able to acknowledge them and all their hard work this holiday season. The winners included David Guffiston at Thank You Books and Aaron Meisner in City Lights were nominated by co-workers and customers, among others. Recipients also included Brandon Conrad of The Nook, Gina Marks of The Links in Gainesville, Florida, and Kirsten Craig of Whale's Tale Books in Lakewood, Colorado. Patterson chose the winners from thousands of applications. We appreciate Mr. Patterson's financial generosity as well as his generosity of spirit. We will continue to be awed by and grateful for Mr. Patterson's continuing support of independent booksellers, Allison Hill, CEO of the American Booksellers Association, said in a statement. It means everything. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM.